Hi, Marco Werman here. Thank you for listening to The World. You already know that our team works hard to find fresh angles and unique voices when we bring you the news. Our stories are global, but we aim to keep the focus local with the people on the ground living close to the day's events. We're able to keep our coverage free and accessible and reach millions of people each week because listeners like you support our nonprofit newsroom. This is our fall fundraising drive, which means it is the perfect time to donate. If you give before November 30th and help us reach our goal, your gift will be matched. That means your support will go twice as far in helping us bring you the news. So if you've been thinking about donating but haven't yet, now is your chance. We can't do this without you. Visit theworld.org/give to double your impact today. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you. And now, the show.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all of these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise also has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
Cities across the globe have gotten used to lockdowns. Residents in Delhi are back inside. Not for COVID. This time, it's pollution.
You know, the sunlight doesn't hit your skin, so you feel a little, strange through the day because it almost feels like a blur has passed you by.
Also today, right now, Brazil has one of the higher COVID vaccination rates in the world. One possible reason? This.
Era uma vez num castelo bem distante, onde nasceu bonequinho muito...
A beloved cartoon character in the shape of a droplet. It's been easing fears of vaccines in Brazil for a generation. And in Ghana, a problem facing many, finding a functioning toilet. There soon may be a solution.
My idea was about the development of a mobile app called T-Toilet.
Open the app, locate a toilet. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's great to have you with us today. There was a sigh of relief when world leaders signed off on a new climate change agreement last week aimed at cleaning up our atmosphere. But this week, residents of India's capital, Delhi, have reason to be skeptical. The people there are smothering under a thick blanket of smog. Air quality is so bad that officials have indefinitely closed schools and shuttered several coal-based power plants.
It is absolutely a nightmare.
That's energy and climate analyst Siddharth Singh. He spent the last 13 years living in Delhi. Recently, the spiking pollution levels in the capital have sent him packing for Goa on India's western coast. In Delhi, Singh told me, the air is inescapable.
There's a certain form of heaviness in the air. As you walk through it, you could almost feel the pollution touch you. It's a very surreal situation where, you know, the sunlight doesn't hit your skin, so you feel a little strange through the day because it almost feels like a blur has passed you by. It's very hard to describe until you actually experience it in person.
Would people in Delhi be tasting this pollution?
Oh, absolutely. Pollution smells and it makes your clothes and your... I have a beard, so it makes my beard smell. Even long after we come back home, and most homes now, most at least middle-class and above homes, have air purifiers at home, and in fact, in most rooms. So, you know, once you're back in the air-purified environment, you can suddenly start smelling the smells that were, you know, hitting you through the day outside.
I mean, I hear the air is so bad, it's the equivalent of smoking 20 cigarettes a day, a pack of cigarettes. What are the health impacts?
The health impacts are dire, and, you know, it's something that most people think affects only the lungs, whereas in fact, the particulate matter is so tiny that it passes right through your lungs, through the natural defenses of the body, and goes into your bloodstream and from your bloodstream into various organs. So, you know, in addition to, of course, it being a, you know, lung issue where, for example, Delhi is the asthma capital of the world because a lot of children, a lot of, you know, even older people have asthma. And doctors will tell you that back in the day, only about 1 in 10 lung cancer patients were not smokers. Whereas today, a majority of the lung cancer patients are not smokers. They are just people living and breathing Delhi's air.
So some homes have air purifiers. There are these orders to stay indoors. How else are people coping?
you know, most people, I think, have not really understood the gravity of the situation. Just about a couple of weeks ago, we had the festival of Diwali, which is the festival of lights. But some people insisted on lighting firecrackers, which lead to even more emissions, even more pollution. And the situation, despite a ban on firecrackers, was quite dire. You had perhaps thousands of people around the city using it. And this really illustrates the fact that most people still don't understand the full nature of health impacts. In fact, it's something that most people realize only when they leave Delhi, only when you're, again, when your eyes are able to adjust and you're able to see into the distance, you realize how bad Delhi really was.
This is not a new phenomenon, though, in Delhi, is it? I mean, in fact, it's fairly predictable with farmers' harvests and climate inversion and Diwali. Can you explain all this, how it's all happening at once?
You know, as I write about this in my book, The Great Smog of India, this smog happens every year, and it happens at about the same time every year. So what happens is, closer to October, weather patterns kind of change. Wind speeds slow down, wind direction changes. As temperature falls, the particulate matter in the air is no longer able to escape. It kind of becomes heavier and falls closer to the ground. We also have the Himalayas on the north, which means that any winds are unable to push the particulate matter into the seas as it happens to the rest of the year. And on top of all of that, it's the harvest season, where farmers are forced to burn the remaining agricultural residue to prepare their land for the next crop.
So if we just look at Delhi, what can officials do about this in the short term? What efforts have been tried?
The problem is that all the efforts that have been tried so far have been efforts in the short term, such as people being asked to carpool, for example, or you have efforts being made to stop farmers from burning stubble by providing them financial incentives. You have the government saying that they're going to get a few thousand natural gas-run buses to encourage public transport. But these are all short-term solutions and they do not work. What Northern India really needs is a master plan for the entire region, where all states, all municipal corporations, all ministries sit down together with long-term targets and are able to plan and work towards those kind of transitions needed in industry, in transport, and most importantly, in agriculture.
Siddharth Singh, an energy and climate analyst and the author of The Great Smog of India. He joined us from Goa on India's western coast. Thank you very much for speaking with us, Siddharth.
Thank you, Marco.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken arrived in Kenya's capital, Nairobi, today. He's on a three-country Africa tour, his first to the continent as America's top diplomat. After Kenya, Blinken will head to Nigeria, then Senegal. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gakandi is in Nairobi following the visit. Halima, why is Kenya the first stop on Blinken's first trip to Africa?
Well, first, Marco, because Kenya and the U.S. are partners on a number of fronts, and they've been strengthening their relationships in the past couple of years. Today, some of what was discussed was, of course, COVID-19. That's on everyone's mind, but also strengthening economic and trade ties. Both countries have roughly $1 billion in annual trade, according to the State Department. They also discussed human rights, climate change, but probably what was most urgent on the table was security. Kenya is a major U.S. security partner in Africa, and Kenya is currently on the UN Security Council. Secretary Blinken said today that he appreciates the role that Kenya has been playing in when it comes to stability and security here in East Africa, especially when it comes to the ongoing conflict in neighboring Ethiopia.
Right. I mean, Ethiopia has been a great concern for the region and the world since fighting broke out in the northern Tigray region a year ago. What did Secretary Blinken have to say today about the ongoing civil war in Ethiopia?
Well, honestly, there were not many updates. We've seen that diplomatic pressure has been continuing from the United States, from the United Nations, from the African Union, and from African countries like Kenya. In fact, Kenya's president, Uhuru Kenyatta, was recently in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, holding private talks with Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed to discuss the ongoing conflict. Here's what Kenya's Cabinet Secretary of Foreign Affairs, Rachel Amamo, said today.
We believe in the potential of Ethiopia to find a resolution to this crisis. We believe that a ceasefire is possible.
So Secretary Blinken also echoed hope for a potential ceasefire. He said a political solution is a necessity, but he also said that this needs to happen in order to get there.
The TPLF and the OLA should halt their advance on Addis. We'd like to see the parties come together at the table to put in place a cessation of hostilities.
And the TPLF is the Tigray People's Liberation Front, of course, which last year attacked a federal defense base in the north, setting off this conflict. And the OLA is the Oromo Liberation Army, another rebel group that joined them against the government. But honestly, it doesn't seem yet like either party is any closer to ending this conflict.
Sudan, of course, is also in the region. It's got to be another priority for the Biden White House. The military in Sudan grabbed power, of course, a few weeks ago. The U.S. and Kenya have both been playing a role there as well. What did Blinken have to say about Sudan today?
Also, not much progress on that front. Sudan is an important country to both the U.S. and Kenya. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs for the U.S., Molly Fee, was in Sudan this week meeting with Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, but he currently is still confined to his home. And the U.S., like much of the international community, has been calling on him to be reinstated to his position, but it doesn't seem like the military is backing down. And on the streets, neither are Sudanese. Today, there were massive protests again across Sudan against the military. So people remain detained. Their families still don't know where they are. And weekly, we continue to hear more reports about protesters on the streets being killed at the hands of security forces.
Halima Gikandi, the world's Africa correspondent based in Nairobi, updating us on Secretary Antony Blinken's first stop on his Africa tour in Kenya. Halima, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
You probably know the feeling. The workday is technically done, then a message pops up. It's the boss asking a question. Make that two questions. I feel your exasperation. In Portugal, those days are over. The world's Bianca Hillier reports.
That's right. No more evening emails. Portugal just passed a set of laws that penalizes companies for contacting employees outside of work hours.
We can use remote work as a game changer in work-life balance.
Ana Mendes Godinho is the country's labor minister. She introduced the legislation, and at the Web Summit conference in Lisbon this month, she said this is a crucial moment to put in place legal protections for remote employees who are burnt out.
The pandemic accelerated the need to regulate what needs to be regulated.
For companies with a staff of 10 or more, the new laws cover a few bases. Employers now have to pay part of the electricity and internet bills of those who work from home. And employees have to meet with their bosses every 2 months to make sure they don't become too disconnected. Labor Minister Mendes Godinho says the laws are also good news for parents.
Parents who have children up to 8 years old, they can decide by their own, and the company cannot oppose remote work.
Remote work is guaranteed for parents of young kids. This legislation is being hailed as one of the boldest approaches to protecting remote workers. But there is one proposal that did not pass in Portugal. It's called the right to disconnect, which would have given workers the legal right to turn off work devices after hours. The French have had this law since 2017. But during the pandemic, more governments are looking into it.
Ontario cannot be a province where people burn out from endless work and family time comes last. We need to give our workers a break.
That's Ontario's labor minister, Monty McNaughton. After looking into what's being done around the world, he introduced right to disconnect legislation late last month.
Whether it's setting out-of-office replies or turning off devices, the message is simple. When you're off the clock, you're off the clock.
If passed, Ontario's law would go into effect in the new year, when analysts say people will definitely still be working from home. Research firm Gartner estimates that 31% of the global workforce will still be at least partially remote in 2022. That's up from just 17% in 2019. To combat pandemic-induced burnout, Spain and Japan are experimenting with a 4-day work week. But some say government intervention is not the best way to improve work-from-home conditions.
I don't think this is a problem that is that amenable to legislation.
Alexander Samuel is a work-from-home expert and co-author of Remote Inc., How to Thrive at Work Wherever You Are. She says penalizing people for sending emails outside of 9-to-5 could create new problems.
For a lot of people, and in particular for a lot of people with caregiving responsibilities, the opportunity to work outside 9 to 5 is actually incredibly beneficial. And forcing everyone into a 9 to 5 structure that is really an artifact of the old workplace is kind of counterproductive.
For what it's worth, Ontario's plan would allow each company to create their own specific policies on disconnecting from work. Samuel says the solutions need to happen on a more granular level, person by person, instead of a right to disconnect. She argues for a right to set your own schedule. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
How a cartoon character helped turn around vaccination rates in Brazil, that story's just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Brazil got off to a slow start with COVID vaccinations, but the country seems to have so far avoided a Delta surge, in large part because roughly 76% of Brazilians have now gotten at least one jab. That's about 7 percentage points higher than the United States. Many Brazilians give credit for their unexpectedly successful vaccination campaign in part to a cartoon character. Michael Fox has that story.
Some of the earliest childhood memories for many Brazilian kids sound something like this.
Papai Noel tá me dizendo que ele veio em setembro porque ele tem uma grande...
In this video from a few years back, a life-sized, white, teardrop-shaped figure stands before a crowd of kids. He wears a huge smile and the logo of Brazil's universal healthcare system, SUS.
Qual é o nome dele? Zé Gotinha!
What's his name? Says a man on the mic. Zé Gotinha! Shout the kids. That's right. Zé Gotinha. I guess you could translate that as Joe the Droplet. He's like Smokey the Bear for Brazil's vaccination program. He's shaped like a drop of liquid because that's how the polio vaccine was administered in Brazil back in the 1980s. And he's been a huge part of the country's world-renowned vaccination program over the last 3 decades, making appearances at health clinics and vaccination drives across the country.
Então, assim, não tem nada que descreva a vacinação como uma coisa boa.
There is nothing better to show the world that vaccinating is good, says Wassim Syed. He's a Brazilian health researcher and a member of the pro-vaccine union. I grew up with Zé Gotinha, he says. I remember taking my vaccine. I remember hugging people dressed up as Zé Gotinha. The character made his debut shortly after the end of the Brazilian dictatorship in 1985, at a time when Brazil was fighting a losing battle against polio and other infectious diseases. Parents and children were suspicious of government vaccination efforts. Darlan Rosa is a sculptor and the artist who created Zé Gotinha.
E na época, o exército brasileiro...
He says the army was involved in the vaccination program then, and they were pretty heavy-handed. When children heard they were coming, they hid. There was a lot of resistance because of the lack of information, he says.
Era uma forma de comunicar com a criança.
Darlan Rosa says, I created Zé Gotinha as a way to communicate with the children. That was my goal, so that a child would say, Dad, today's vaccination day. Would you bring me to the health clinic to see Zé Gotinha, he says. It worked. According to Rosa, in the era of polio, Brazil vaccinated as many as 20 million children on a single day. The disease was eradicated in Brazil by 1990.
Era uma vez num castelo bem distante, onde nasceu bonequinho muito simpático.
In this cartoon from the same year, Zé Gotinha looks a little like Casper the Friendly Ghost, but with a pointier head. He dances through a neighborhood protecting children from these ugly monsters who are stand-ins for infectious diseases like polio, tetanus, or the measles. Today, 3 generations of Brazilians have grown up with Zé Gotinha. Many say the little guy is responsible for the country's overwhelming vaccine acceptance, despite resistance from President Jair Bolsonaro and some of his supporters.
A vacina uma vez certificada pela Anvisa vai ser...
Bolsonaro has long said he will not be vaccinated. Last year, he rejected early offers to purchase vaccines from Pfizer and other companies and joked that the COVID-19 vaccine might turn you into a crocodile. In late October, Facebook removed a video where he falsely claimed the shot could cause AIDS.
Isso tem sido muito bom porque a gente vê que...
Researcher Wassim Syed says, we have seen that although there has been this anti-vax discourse, people are still going out and getting vaccinated. And that's also due to Zé Gotinha and this whole campaign going back years showing the people that vaccines are good, he says. But despite the progress, still there is resistance. Renata Rivera is a São Paulo-based doctor.
E na verdade hoje nós atravessamos uma crise, não somente contra a vacinação.
We're going through a crisis, not just with vaccinations against COVID, but also a crisis over the coverage of the other vaccinations. We've been losing ground against polio, tuberculosis, and the measles. The truth is that not even Zegochinha seems to be able to help jumpstart Brazil's immunization program, Renata says. That might be because the character has been largely absent under the Bolsonaro government, which has refused to use Zegochinha to promote health safety and COVID-19 vaccinations.
Cadê o Zegochinha? Cadê o nosso querido Zegochinha?
Where's Zegochinha? Former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva asked supporters in March. Where's our beloved Zegochinha? Bolsonaro sent him away because he said he was a leftist, Lula said. The same month, Jair Bolsonaro's son Eduardo, who's a senator, tried to rebrand the lovable character. He tweeted out a picture of Zegochinha holding a syringe like a machine gun, the president's signature pose.
Eu fiquei muito indignado, e aí eu fui para as redes sociais.
I was so angry, says Zegochinha's creator Darlan Rosa. Everyone was. I still get choked up. On social media, there was a huge response in Zegochinha's defense. These are the children from yesterday, the parents of today, vaccinated by Zegochinha. Rosa says he's concerned about the anti-vax movement, particularly in the United States, where he has two grandchildren. I just want everyone to be protected, he says. That's what Zegochinha wants, too. For The World, I'm Michael Fox.
Yesterday on The World, we updated you on the volcano in Spain's Canary Islands that's been erupting for nearly 2 months now. Reporter Barbara Belt gave us some stunning descriptions of the ash and lava that are disrupting thousands of people's lives on the island of La Palma. There was one more story she told us about five podencos, hunting dogs that got stuck during the ordeal.
They look about a little bit like the dogs on Egyptian hieroglyphics. They're skinny. They've got big ears. There were five podencos up on the roof of a house.
In the early days of the Cumbre Vieja eruption, the dogs were spotted in drone footage taken by the Geological Society. They were alone on the roof of a house surrounded by lava and volcanic debris. Cue the rescue effort.
Then there was a whole protocol that was implemented. They were getting special experts to come down from Spain who were going to use a heavy-duty drone with a net on it, which they were going to drop down, entice the dogs in with some food because they were, of course, very hungry by then. They'd been there for a while, and hoist them up again and fly them away.
It took some time to muster the equipment, the team, and access to the site.
And this team finally arrived from Spain, made their way to the exclusion zone and had a look. No dogs.
The five podencos had disappeared from the rooftop.
But what there was a banner saying, everybody relax, the dogs are safe. And it said, Equipo A, A-team, at the bottom. So nobody knew who the A-team were, and they still don't. Well, I'm sure somebody does, but it's certainly not common knowledge. I think it was just a little bit of tongue-in-cheek there about the protocols and the restrictions and, you know, it wasn't necessary. We could go in and do it anyway and we've done it. You know, I think it was a little bit like that.
The dogs had gained enough celebrity to be secretly rescued, famous enough to generate some fake news.
At first, there was a lot of misinformation up on the social networks. There were photographs of dogs. Everybody claimed to have rescued them. You know how these things go for weird reasons that I am yet to understand. And in the end, the information was sent to a kind of an enthusiast's magazine, hunting magazine. The photos of the dogs saying, yes, we've got the dogs. They're all right. We're going to give them back to the owners. We're waiting for all the hoo-ha to die down. We're feeding them up again. And the owners said, yes, those are our dogs.
So the dogs are alive and well, soon to be returned to their owners.
And nobody knows who the mysterious A-team are.
Reporter Barbara Belt on the Canary Island of La Palma and the rest of us still pondering that question. You're listening to The World. The 2024 Paris Olympic Committee wants to hold swimming events in the Seine. Problem is, it's not exactly clean. An 11-year-old in Paris wants to fix that.
So for Christmas 2019, the then 9-year-old asked his parents for several meters of rope, a hook, and a super powerful magnet.
We'll tell you what he fished out coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Today, the Biden administration announced a major new investment in vaccine manufacturing. The goal is to help address global vaccine inequities. The World's Alana Gordon joins us to unpack what kind of difference this can really make. First of all, what kind of expansion are we talking about here, Alana?
Well, Dr. David Kessler, the chief science officer for the U.S. COVID response, laid out some of the details during a House Appropriations hearing this morning.
The United States government is seeking to enter into an historic partnership with one or more experienced pharmaceutical manufacturers to increase mRNA vaccine U.S.-based production capacity for domestic and global use by at least 1 billion doses annually.
So the idea is the government would be investing billions of more dollars in domestic manufacturing of mRNA vaccines to help address both domestic and global needs moving forward starting next year. And this has been in the works for some time. The funding's already been set aside through the American Rescue Plan.
Kessler really pushed hard on the word global there. How important is an initiative like this, expanding manufacturing?
So more manufacturing means more shots. Long term, the U.S. is also leading the world in global vaccine donations. Kessler really stressed that, too, in his testimony. But a lot of critics, Marco, say that this doesn't address the root of the problem. I checked in with a longtime healthcare activist, Asia Russell, who's usually based in Uganda. She's director of Global Health Gap.
This catastrophe could have been prevented if countries in Africa, countries in Latin America and the Caribbean, countries across the global south in Southeast Asia had had sufficient indigenous manufacturing capacity, which requires not an injection of public money into U.S. domestic production.
What Asia Russell is saying is that it requires an injection of support for manufacturing that's controlled by and based in these other regions, not the U.S. and Europe. Right now, companies like Moderna, Pfizer, they control those decisions and deals, and they don't want to give up that control. And there's an urgency to all of this in countries around the world that lack access. Russell points out that in places like Uganda, schools have been closed for more than a year and a half. So there's just a lot of fallout and damage, not just from the vaccines themselves, but from the domino effect of what that means.
But going back to this announcement, Ilana, isn't ramping up the supply a good thing? Won't that address some of this access issue?
So for a reality check, I reached out to Dr. Krishna Ayudakumar about this. He's over at Duke's Global Health Institute, and he's been tracking the details and distributions of what is available right now, what's lacking. And he says the announcement, it is a good step, like more vaccines are good. But there's something that might not be obvious of what is happening right now.
If you look at overall vaccine manufacturing capacity, it's already increasing pretty significantly. Just Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna are projecting capacity in 2022 to produce almost 7 billion doses.
So what he's saying is the world actually has a good amount of vaccines right now. So short term, there's a distribution problem. If high-income countries were to vaccinate 75% of their populations, plus boosters, they're still projected to have hundreds of millions of excess doses. And so in the short term, he says, more has to be done to move the stockpile, not in a matter of months or years, but in a matter of days or weeks to places that really need it. And right now, there's just not a lot of transparency around this or the mechanisms to ensure that it happens.
The World's Ilana Gordon, thank you very much for this.
Thanks, Marco.
In 3 years, Paris will host the Summer Olympics. How cool will it be to see marathoners striding down the Champs-Élysées or swimmers battling it down the Seine? The Paris mayor's office has invested more than $1 billion to depollute the toxic bacteria floating in the Seine. There's still a lot of debris, though, at the bottom of the river, and that challenge has been taken on by an 11-year-old boy. Reporter Rebecca Rossman in Paris recently met him.
On est bon?
Most 11-year-olds would probably rather spend their weekend sleeping in, but Raphael isn't like most 11-year-olds. We're standing under the Pont de Beaugrenelle in western Paris on this cloudy gray Saturday morning as he and his dad Alexandre prepare to go fishing. But not for fish, more like for smartphones, bike locks, scooters.
1 year ago here we find a rocket.
A rocket dating all the way back to World War II.
So we called the police, and it closed all the area.
For about 2 years now, the pair has spent nearly every Saturday and Sunday fishing debris out of the Seine, sometimes collecting more than 1 ton in a single day.
Un jour, je regardais YouTube,
The idea came to Raphael after he watched a video on YouTube of someone doing something similar. So for Christmas 2019, the then 9-year-old asked his parents for several meters of rope, a hook, and a super powerful magnet that could attract metal objects weighing more than a ton.
Forcément, j'étais surpris parce que...
Initially taken back by the request, his dad says he was rest assured, even impressed, once Raphael showed him the YouTube video. Raphael says while at first these, quote, fishing trips started as a leisurely weekend activity, they turned into more or less a full-time job once he realized just how much debris there was buried at the bottom of the river.
C'est là qu'on s'est dit, pour sensibiliser les gens.
I wanted other people to know too, he says. That's when he started his Instagram account, Raph sur Seine, which now has more than 20,000 followers. He shares some of his best objects at a makeshift museum located in his dad's basement, including horseshoes, a DSLR camera, and even a 19th century bayonet. The goal, show off the Seine's buried treasure, but more importantly, encourage others to join in the fight against pollution. Raphael admits getting people to act has been a challenge.
Mais il y a quoi? Il y a 7 milliards de personnes sur la Terre, il y en a...
Still, he says he's encouraged by his progress in the last 2 years. He points to a section of the Seine that's noticeably clearer than the rest of the river. That's where he started fishing in January 2020. And while he's not sure if he can make the entire Seine glisten by the 2024 Olympics, he hopes to be one of the first to swim in the water once it's safe. For The World, Rebecca Rossman, Paris.
Some good news to report in the world of infectious diseases. A 30-year-old woman in Argentina appears to have cured herself of the HIV virus. This is only the second documented case of this ever. Joining us to discuss is Dr. Bruce Walker, one of the co-authors of the study and a leading HIV researcher here in Boston. Doctor, tell us about this patient in Argentina.
So this is a woman, a 30-year-old woman, who was infected about 10 years ago with HIV, and remarkably, despite not being on medications, had no detectable virus in her bloodstream and has continued to do entirely well. In fact, had given birth to a baby without transmitting the virus to the baby. What's remarkable about this patient is that it appears that she has been controlling HIV on her own with her immune system. It's the same way that most people take care of viruses like mono. The immune system keeps the virus in check, even though it never eliminates it. In fact, HIV ends up being a lifelong infection because it becomes part of a person's DNA, and in that state is not able to be eliminated by drugs, and we thought was not able to be eliminated by the immune system. But in this case, it actually looks like she has been able to eliminate the virus on her own without the need for medication.
As I said, this is only the second time this has happened or been documented. There was another patient in California who got rid of the virus. What do we actually mean, though, when they say they cure themselves? You said it's the immune system kind of taking over. Was this woman in Argentina working intentionally to make that happen?
No, this was not something intentional. It appears that this happens occasionally. What we knew from the San Francisco patient, the first one identified to have apparently cured her infection, she had never taken medications. And when we looked at over a billion cells, we were unable to find any infectious virus, indicating that at least one person in the world had been able to do this. I think what's significant about this is now we have a second individual, so we know that this is not just a one-off thing. In both cases, the evidence suggests that it's their own immune system, in fact, a particular kind of immune cell that is likely causing the virus to be eliminated, not just from the bloodstream, but also from the DNA.
What can researchers learn from these two cases?
Well, I think what we can learn from these two cases is that what we know is that in at least two individuals, we have seen elimination of infectious virus. And that shows that that is possible. And as we understand how their immune systems are functioning, we can try and replicate their kind of immunity in other individuals to see if we can actually get other people to not just control the infection without drug therapy, but also potentially eliminate the virus altogether.
I'm curious, on the HIV front, I mean, did the achievement, miraculous in many ways, of several COVID vaccines in record time, did it inject some new energy to find a vaccine for HIV?
I think in terms of a vaccine for HIV, that has remained elusive. And in fact, during the COVID pandemic, clinical trial that we were involved in with a test of a vaccine for HIV didn't work, but that same vaccine platform worked for COVID. So HIV is just a very, very difficult virus to treat. It's a difficult virus to eliminate. But I think these patients show us that it's possible to eliminate infectious HIV from the body. And I think that gives us hope that we can get smart enough to replicate this in other people. There's a lot yet to be done, but we're optimistic.
Dr. Bruce Walker, director of the Reagan Institute at Massachusetts General Hospital, MIT, and Harvard, speaking with us about a new study that found the world's second person, a woman in Argentina, who appears to have eliminated HIV from her body. Dr. Walker, thanks very much for explaining this.
Thank you.
Friday marks World Toilet Day, and if you rarely worry about where you will go if you have to go, this day may seem silly, but spare a thought for more than 4 billion people who don't have a properly working toilet. In Ghana, nearly 20,000 people each year, including more than 5,000 children under age 5, die from diarrhea, and that is driven by poor hygiene and sanitation. But increasingly, the problem is being dealt with in innovative ways. Reporter Ridwan Karim Dini Osman reports from Ghana's capital, Accra.
Close to 50,000 residents are crammed into a sizable community of low-rise wood, concrete, and rusted iron roofing sheets. The neighborhood of Nima is indeed a squeeze. Here, I meet Rose Al-Hassan frying fish with her 8-year-old granddaughter, who is fanning a coal pot with red-hot charcoal. Her house has 9 rooms, accommodating 32 people.
We were almost there.
The lack of toilet in this house really worries me a lot because the closest public toilet is about 10 minutes walk from here, and I have rheumatism, which gets really unbearable when I walk for that long.
She ends up having to use a plastic bag, which she discards in the open drain. In Ghana, 1 in 5 people defecate openly, while only 1 in 7 households in the West African country have toilet facilities. Bags not only choke the gutters, but the open drains also pollute the air, making it pungent.
All the houses around here don't have toilets, so usually when you wake up early in the morning, you will see people throwing toilets in the drain.
Ghanaian law requires landlords to provide toilets for their tenants, with associated penalties for defaulters. However, over the years, effective enforcement of this law has been lax. At the public toilet, I see huge cracks on the building with perforated and rusty roofing. Inside are 12 open cubicles. The heat here is choking, and the smell a cocktail of urine, cigarette smoke, and piles of feces. Health authorities say scenes like these are often hotbeds of infections and diseases like cholera, diarrhea, or typhoid. Outside, a long queue of desperate patrons waiting to take their turn. They pay 1 cedi for a tissue paper or 50 pesos for a used newspaper to access this public toilet. In line, Mariatu Muhammad says coming here at night is a risky affair.
There is no toilet in my house, and so I meander through so many corners before I get here. And for a girl or woman like me, it is dangerous, especially at night.
Gender activist Lilipel Babautu is concerned about the disproportionate impact of the problem on women and girls in Ghana.
My work has taken me to so many communities where women had to step out at night, you know, use the bushes because there are no toilets to use, and they are pounced on by either kidnappers, rapists.
Otu says lack of toilets can also cause menstrual health needs of women and girls to go unmet. But the situation is not all gloom and doom. In the sprawling community of Adama, a constructor clad in a black apron is using his shovel to dig into a mixture of sand, cement and gravel. He uses the bag the cement came in as a helmet. After many years without a toilet, this large house, home to some 16 tenants, is putting up one. Resident Ernest Fuller led the fundraising effort.
As a household, we decided to come together, contribute little by little to start this toilet project that you are seeing right now.
The World Bank in 2013 financed the $150 million project aimed at providing water and sanitation in deprived communities in Ghana's capital. Beneficiary households and institutions pay 30% of the cost. The project has constructed about 30,000 household toilet facilities. To complement efforts like these, UNICEF, together with its partners, have begun a hackathon for young people to showcase their innovative solutions towards ending open defecation in their communities. 14-year-old Nana Kweku Amwaku Oduro Mensa is one of the participants.
My idea was about the development of a mobile app called T-Toilet for people to locate toilet facilities within their vicinity.
Here is 13-year-old Barbara Parker.
People have toilet facilities all right, but they don't really have the ways to use it. So they need continuous education and sensitization on how to use it.
Access to sanitation is a human right and part of the UN Sustainable Development Goals. This means that by 2030, open defecation must end and everyone must have access to toilets for improved dignity and living conditions. For the world, I am Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
Colombia is the biggest global producer of cocaine, so the government in Bogota is trying to restart a controversial program to use herbicides to eradicate coca plants, which are processed to make cocaine powder. But farmers in remote areas worry that fumigation will contaminate food and water, cause health problems, and ultimately cut off their income. From the province of Guaviare in central Colombia, Stephen Grattan has a story.
A long drive down a dirt road and a trek through tangled vegetation takes us to a coca farmer's wooden cabin. A gun sits on the table beside the hammock where he rests on his porch. At just 36 years old, he has leathered skin on his face and hands from years of tough farm work and smoking. Out of fear of being traced by the government, the timid farmer asks us not to use his name. We trek into the forest behind his home. He uses a machete to help clear away the branches, a slope which drops down to a narrow river where he placed a thin tree trunk, the only crossing to the other side. He's made it difficult for any government forces to get to his illegal shrubs and destroy them. On the other side of the river is his glistening coca crop. He strips the emerald leaves from the small shrubs. Beside the fields, covered by trees, there's a piece of fallen tarp and plastic barrels. It's here where he processes the coca leaves into a type of paste, later taken elsewhere and made into cocaine. He's explaining how the coca leaves are cut up and put in barrels, and gasoline and other chemicals are added. He knows it's illegal, but the farmer says it's his only choice to make ends meet in this impoverished region. He recalls the days aeroplanes would fly overhead and spray the herbicide glyphosate on his fields. The plane would come down really low to whatever was underneath it. A lot of the time it didn't even fall on the plants. It falls on the forest, in the water, on the grasslands, on the animals, and not on the coca plants. Cocaine production in Colombia is at an all-time high, and the government is under pressure by the United States to restart aerial fumigation. The US supported the method of coca eradication here for 25 years. Colombia's government has said it is the most effective method of eradicating large swaths of coca plants and less dangerous for eradication teams. They can face attacks by armed groups who own and defend coca fields around the country, at times even planting landmines.
You have to have
many ways in which you can deal with it. And of course, it should include aerial spray.
Right-wing Senator Paloma Valencia told me aerial fumigation may not be the best method of eradication, but it's the only way to make a significant dent on the illegal organizations that produce it.
Well, I think the problem of cocaine is that's our biggest enemy, because cocaine can finance all the violence against Colombia.
Some Colombian scientific reports say glyphosate can have detrimental effects on nearby food crops, pollute soil and water supplies. In 2015, the World Health Organization warned it could be a potential human carcinogenic, prompting the Colombian government in power at the time to stop using it. Glyphosate is often sold under the brand name Roundup in the United States, where many have fought against the use of the weed killer. The US Environmental Protection Agency says the chemical does not cause cancer, although some European countries, like Germany, are trying to ban glyphosate by 2023. Meanwhile, the 2016 Colombian peace deal had a significant focus on moving rural farmers away from cultivating illegal crops. But government payments for legal crops were delayed, and many farmers have returned to growing coca. It's estimated that some 250,000 Colombian families are currently involved. Pedro Arenas is an ex-mayor in the region who runs a think tank dedicated to drug policy reform.
Estamos promoviendo que ellos dejen de...
We are asking that they stop putting money into aerial fumigation, Arena says, because those aerial sprayings are not against drug trafficking or drug traffickers. They are against poor farmers who earn the least from this production chain. Arenas is advocating so the Biden administration stops supporting fumigation. In the town of Charras, Luz Angela Gascar just killed and skinned a chicken in front of me for the soup she's making for lunch. She's concerned about the health effects of glyphosate on her family.
Me gustaría mandarle a decir al gobierno pues que la aspersión aérea no es buena.
She says aerial fumigation isn't good. Look for another method and give us new ways to be able to work, because us farmers are forced to go back to planting coca because the government has not delivered. The Colombian government has delivered its outline to the Constitutional Court on how they plan to restart aerial fumigation, meeting the new environmental and safety guidelines set by the court back in 2019. The court's decision is now a waiting game for those around Colombia who continue to produce coca. And as the fifth anniversary of the peace deal approaches, a decision in favour of restarting aerial spraying without offering financial alternatives would be another blow for those rural farmers, many of whom feel peace never arrived. For The World, I'm Stephen Grattan in Guaviare, Colombia.
A self-portrait by the Mexican artist Frida Kahlo has broken the record for highest-selling work of art from Latin America. When the hammer came down yesterday at Sotheby's in New York, her painting, whose title translates as Diego and I, sold for nearly $35 million. It shows Kahlo with a small portrait on her forehead of her husband, the painter Diego Rivera. A promotional video by Sotheby's explains that Rivera and Kahlo were some of the most celebrated intellectuals in Mexico, along with Nobel Prize-winning poet Octavio Paz.
Octavio Paz described Frida Kahlo's paintings as revelations. Pathways into her psyche.
Kahlo and Rivera's tumultuous relationship, they married each other twice, was almost as well known as their art. This is from a 1950s radio show. Mexican experts believe it's possibly the only known recording of Frida Kahlo.
Con su cabeza asiática, sobre la que nace un pelo oscuro, tan delgado y fino que parece flotar en el aire, es un niño grandote, inmenso.
The reading here is from an essay Kahlo wrote about her husband, in which she shares some of her admiration and affection for him. In her painting, Kahlo is known for inserting a folk style in her often surreal self-portraits. She died in 1954, later emerging as a feminist icon in Mexico and across Latin America, not to mention her image appearing on T-shirts, coffee mugs, and memes across the globe. But for her actual work to command a record-breaking sum, that's a legacy that swag can't hold a candle to. You can check out that multi-million dollar work of art. There's a photo on our Twitter feed. We are at The World. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.